For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're starting a new series that I've entitled The Essential Jesus. What we're going to do, I mean, often you study the life of Jesus by taking one of the four first books, the first four books of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and studying all the way through them. But instead, we're going to look at the key events in Jesus's life, the key elements of his public ministry, and draw from all four of those books to do that. It's pretty much without any dispute that Jesus of Nazareth is the most widely known and most influential religious figure who has ever existed. No one really disputes that. After all, most of the world marks time by the birth of Christ, whether we call it B.C. before Christ or before Common Era. The point is that we mark time by reference to his life. Between 1 and 2 billion people today in every political nation on earth affirm Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God. Virtually every major world religion pays homage to Jesus, although they often reinvent Jesus into a figure that fits in with their religious worldview. So, for example, in Islam, Jesus is honored as a prophet, but a prophet subordinate to Muhammad and obviously inferior to Allah. In Buddhism, Jesus is honored as an enlightened master, a guru, one of many such enlightened masters, rather than the world's sole savior from sin. Now, for me to even say that certain groups reinvent Jesus presumes that we can know who the real Jesus is. That we can actually have reliable knowledge about who Jesus claimed to be, what he did, so that we can use that knowledge as a standard by which to evaluate other portraits of Jesus. And until really about 50 years ago in this culture, though by no means has this culture been predominantly Christian ever, but until about 50 years ago, the kind of cultural consensus was that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those works which we're going to talk about quite a bit this morning, which I will call the canonical Jesus, the Jesus that is described for us by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's the real Jesus. But in the last 50 years, that cultural consensus has pretty much evaporated. And through a lot of different avenues, like scholars, like novels, like TV channels, and like the ubiquitous and, of course, highly reliable internet, that consensus has evaporated. And really, if there is any cultural consensus about this question in our culture today, is that the canonical Jesus is itself a reinvention. So that's where we are today, and it only makes sense that if we're going to study about Jesus, we got to start with how can we know who the real Jesus was, or can we? Why not the Da Vinci Code Jesus? I'm just using the Da Vinci Code as a good representative of the new cultural consensus. Of course, that was a wildly best-selling novel by Dan Brown, and that book, although it was fictional, was rooted in the views of other scholars like Elaine Pagels and her famous book, the Gnostic Gospels. I'm summarizing for you what may be the closest thing to a cultural consensus about Jesus today. I'm summarizing Pagels mainly. And that Jesus, we're told, never claimed to be the divine Son of God, that this was something that church leaders wrote back into his mouth centuries later, that he only ever claimed to be a Hebrew teacher. The Da Vinci Code Jesus was a more like a New Age master in many ways who promoted spiritual enlightenment, and one of the means to spiritual enlightenment, according to this portrait, is through sexual intercourse. This Jesus, we're told, actually married Mary Magdalene, that he sired a daughter by her, that Jesus, the real Jesus, designated Mary Magdalene to be the leader of the church after he was gone, but that this was later erased and substituted with a bachelor version of Jesus that supported later church leaders' asceticism and their male chauvinism. This Da Vinci Code Jesus, this is really kind of the key assumption. The key assumption is that in the early 300s, when Emperor Constantine supposedly converted to Christ, the view is that then he brought together various leaders of the church, that there was already wild disagreement, wild divergence of views of who Jesus were. There were over 70 different gospels circulating that go all the way back to the first century. And that what happened is that Constantine and certain church leaders chose our four gospels because they portrayed the picture of Jesus that the leaders wanted, and that they marginalized, villainized, or extinguished the other versions. So what we have is the portrait of the winners. So goes Pagel's theory, that they, and you do see that in fallen human history. When people gain power, they often rewrite history to support their own agenda. And so they're saying this is just one more power play. Those are some of the other gospels or accounts of the life of Christ that have been found and known about for many centuries. We'll talk a little bit more about them today and again next week. And that the New Testament, as we have it now, has evolved over centuries through countless translations, through countless additions, deletions, revisions, so that what even those four books said originally, no one can really know, because that's been lost through the 20th century telephone game, where you tell a story and to someone else and it gradually gets changed. And so what this results in is kind of a cultural atmosphere in which people are much more profoundly skeptical about the canonical Jesus, the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and a cultural atmosphere in which people are far more agnostic about whether we could ever know who Jesus really was anyway. That is very different place that we're at than five decades ago. And this is part of the challenge for those who believe in the canonical Jesus to respond to this new consensus. So what I want to do then is review or summarize with you, overview with you, some of the evidence for the argument that the Jesus that we read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is the real Jesus. This is the real portrait of Jesus, the standard by which we have to evaluate other versions. If you're interested in looking into this subject in a little bit more detail, this would be a good place to begin. The book Jesus Under Fire, it's several conservative New Testament scholars who are dealing with this issue. Now, let me just overview the reasons for believing that the Jesus in the Gospels is the real Jesus. First of all, these are undeniably the earliest written accounts of the life of Jesus. Mark was written as early as 55 AD. John may have been written as late as 90 AD. So they're all first century documents written within decades of the life of Jesus. And if you know anything about history, that you know that when you study history, the earlier, the closer the documents are to the events themselves, the more likely they are to be reliable. By contrast, all of the other so-called Gospels of Jesus were written 140 AD or much later. So 140 AD is the date assigned to the so-called Gospel of Thomas. Well, that means, for one thing, that the Gospel of Thomas was not written by Jesus' disciple Thomas, because all the disciples were long dead by 140 AD. And the other works, as I said, are much later still. So these are the earliest accounts. They are also eyewitness accounts. Matthew and John were two of the original 12 disciples of Jesus. Mark himself was an eyewitness of the ministry of Jesus as a young man, and he wrote, we're told, the memoirs in addition of Peter, who was Jesus' disciple. And Luke tells us expressly that he compiled his account by interviewing many eyewitnesses of the life of Christ. Now, again, when you do history, you want not only the earliest documents, but if you can get eyewitness accounts, that's the very most reliable kind of document. Especially if the authors of those documents were willing to make great sacrifices to stand by their testimony. And of course, this was the case with Matthew, Peter, John. They all were persecuted or imprisoned or went to their deaths rather than retract their claim that Jesus, not Caesar, really is the Lord and the rightful Savior of humanity. By contrast, again, the other Gospels were written much later and therefore, by definition, were not eyewitness accounts. Another important feature here is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't just give a list of sayings of Jesus. By the way, the Gospel of Thomas should not be called the Gospel of Thomas, because gospel means a historical, at least the way it's being used here, it means a historical narrative of the life of Christ. The Gospel of Thomas is not a historical narrative. It's 114 disconnected supposed sayings of Jesus. There is no historical narrative. There is no interface in the Gospel of Thomas, for example, with other people, places, and events that we can verify from outside the Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John make hundreds of mentions of people, places, events that we can corroborate or falsify by reading other first century historical documents. So this is, in a sense, an area of great vulnerability for those documents. And as little as 150 years ago, scholars said, well, as archaeology really becomes more widespread, we'll excavate and find that these documents were false, that they were written long after the fact, and they're filled with historical inaccuracies. But just the opposite has happened. Ancient archaeology related to the Bible has done nothing but corroborate or strengthen confidence in the reliability of these documents. This quote from Craig Blomberg, a New Testament scholar, he says, archaeology confirms a whole raft of details that are susceptible to archaeological corroboration. For example, the existence of the pools of Siloam and Bethesda in Jerusalem, including the point that John made that the Pool of Bethesda had five porticos or five porches. This was long thought to have been just ridiculous, but they've excavated both pools and the five porticos. The archaeological evidence for Pontius Pilate being prefect of Judea at that time. Archaeological evidence for the fact that Romans crucified their victims by driving spikes through the victims' ankles. It was long thought, no, they were only hung or hung by their wrists, but not by their ankles. But now we have first century crucifixion skeletons validating that. Excavation of the tomb of Caiaphas, the high priest who sentenced Jesus to death. Excavation of the bone box of James, the Lord's brother. And so on. All of these details in the Gospels were once doubted before archaeological confirmation came forth. Now, we're not saying that archaeology has confirmed every historical statement in the Gospels. We're saying that overwhelmingly, the result of archaeological research is to confirm their reliability. another line of evidence for the reliability of the Gospel's portrait of Jesus is that we have the writings of church fathers that go all the way back to the end of the first century. And you may remember that the Da Vinci Code view is that all the way back to the first century, there were all these divergent views of Jesus and no consensus whatever about who he really was. And this is demonstrably false because you go back to the earliest church fathers at the end of the first century and into the second century, and they speak with one voice, quoting Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as the authoritative portrait of the real Jesus. So there always was a consensus, it turns out, all the way back. Some emperor did not convene a mandatory council where people brought whole wheelbarrows of different portraits of Jesus, and then that someone pulled a power play to pick the four that supported their political agenda. There always was a consensus. These are the four that are accurate and authentic. And then there is the fact that, no, it's not like a 20th century game of send the message, the telephone game has been the case. The fact is that we can prove that the original content of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John has been preserved in a remarkably accurate way. In fact, it is not even debated that the New Testament documents, we can vouch for their accurate preservation way more than any other ancient document. When you're dealing with ancient literary or historical documents, it's common to have only half dozen or less total copies and to have the time between their original composition and the earliest copies to be 5 to 10 centuries. With the New Testament, we have over 5,000 ancient copies that go back within just over 200 years of their original composition. And we have fragments of the New Testament writings, including the Gospel of John, that go back to the early 2nd century. We have a fragment from John's Gospel that goes back to within about 25 years of when he wrote it. And they found it in Egypt. So the evidence, now this is what you say, what's the big deal there? Well, the more copies you have, the more you can compare them, the more you can find the very occasional copyist error, which does happen, and correct that. Even the copyist errors that have been found through this voluminous research, as one scholar, Bruce Metzger, says, doesn't change in the least the message that the New Testament documents tell us. We have the message of the original authors. And then, lastly, you may remember that the Da Vinci Code Jesus saying, look, you know, these guys, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they had an agenda for their Gospels. They were writing their accounts of the life of Christ to try to convince other people to believe in Jesus as the Messiah. And so since they had an agenda, you can't trust what they say. That's a very cynical perspective. You really could not learn anything at all about history if you really believe that, because there's never been a historical work that hasn't been written without some kind of agenda. There's no such thing. The real issue is not that the fact that they had an agenda impeaches what they say, but that we need to look at the evidence like we just surveyed. Blomberg again says, simply because a writer is passionately committed to promoting a particular cause does not at all mean that he will necessarily falsify the facts. After all, often such a person will work all the harder to tell the story straight because the truthfulness of that story is what produced the personal commitment in the first place. You say, I don't really understand what that means. Look, what do we say about the research of the Holocaust survivors? The many Jewish people, some of whom still alive, who devoted their life to documenting the historical fact of the Holocaust. Should we say that since they had an agenda, we can't trust their research? Because they're very clear that they had an agenda. Their agenda is, we don't want anyone to be able to say down the road that this never happened because we don't ever want it to happen again. Well, that's a pretty clear agenda. I guess that means we can't trust any of their research. See, the point is that that's not how you determine the trustworthiness of historical research. You determine it by those criteria. And it is absolutely the case that the portrait of Mark and Matthew and Luke and John as historical documents is like Jesus is one of the most attested, reliably attested ancient figures. In fact, these two folks who are Jewish non-Christian historians in their work conclude, we know the truth is because of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we know more about Jesus than about any other, almost any other first century Jew. That's quite an acknowledgement from people who do not believe in Jesus as the Messiah. Makes you wonder who the other first century Jew is that we know even more about, do you know? It's Paul. There's even more written source material about the Apostle Paul than there is 13 of his letters and then the works of Luke and in the book of Acts, etc. These are the two people that we know the most about because of the historical reliability of their account, the accounts that describe his life. I don't know whether your response to this is so what, or the main point that I'm trying to make is that increasingly we live in a culture which says basically, make Jesus whoever you want him to be. Make a designer Jesus. You know, make Jesus into the genie that fits your plan for your life. And who's to say that yours is any less valid than any others? Because we can't really know. And for you to say that the canonical Jesus is the Jesus is an act of blind faith. And the point is, it's not an act of blind faith. In fact, you'd have to exercise a lot of blind faith not to acknowledge this is the Jesus that really lived. Now, you still have to decide whether you want to bow to him or whether you want to reject him. That's up to your free choice. But it's not a matter of blind faith to realize this is who he said he was. This is what he did. So it's only fitting that before we start a series on Jesus drawn from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that we go through. We won't go through this every week by any means, but it's good that we start here. It's the right place to start. Okay, and so having done that, then let's just start, and we'll start at the beginning. That is, in our New Testaments, we'll start with Matthew 1, Jesus' family tree. And I didn't put it up on the screen, and you can read if you want, or you can listen to me read it in my small print radio voice. It says, the record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brother Judah. The father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David the king. David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam the father of Abijah. Abijah the father of Asa. Asa the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat the father of Joram. Joram the father of Uzziah. Uzziah the father of Jotham. Jotham the father of Ahaz. Ahaz the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah the father of Manasseh. Manasseh the father of Ammon. Ammon the father of Josiah. Josiah became the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah became the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Atzor. Atzor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Eliud. Eliud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Matan. Matan, the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah.
Maybe I should moonlight. Now, in the next verse, he says, so you can remember this. If you remember, I gave you 14 names between Abraham to David, and another 14 names between David and the deportation to Babylon, and a final 14 set of names between the deportation to Babylon and Jesus. He says, that's a good way to remember this, if you would want to. I mean, we read this. I mean, these passages like this are the ones that we just skip over, right? It's like, you don't tell people, just start reading the Bible from the beginning, because when they hit chapter 4 and 5 of Genesis and they hit the genealogies, it's a shipwreck, right? I mean, I can get interest in family trees. I'm pretty interested in my family tree. But I don't expect other people to be interested in my family tree. My mom always told me growing up that I was descended both from General Robert E. Lee, that's good, that's great, and from Jefferson Davis, the first and only Confederate president. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's interesting to me, right? But why does Matthew expect his readers to be interested in this? And we know that Matthew's original audience were Jewish people that he was trying to convince that Jesus was the Messiah. Well, there's at least a couple of answers to that question. One is more obvious than the other, and we'll just walk through those with the time we have left. The first and most obvious answer to the question is that he does this to show that Jesus came in fulfillment of this promise that God made about a coming Messiah. He says, this is the family tree of Jesus, the Messiah. That means God's anointed ruler, God's chosen king. The son, which means descendant of David, and also the descendant of Abraham. Why does he begin with that summary? Well, David and Abraham are probably the two biggest names in this genealogy. But he doesn't include them just because they were celebrities. He includes them because of the promises that God made to Abraham and to David that he would bring from their family tree the Messiah one day. Way back in 2100 years before Jesus, God spoke to Abraham, the first Jew, and said, among other things, I will make you into a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great. So the idea that he would have descendants when he had no descendants, when God promised this, and that it would be a great nation and that he would become famous, that's really cool. But the blessing, God's blessing of Abraham was not to be an end in itself. He says, and so you will be a blessing to others. I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to others. And in verse 3, God says, namely, that in you or through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. The word families here, mishpaha, means ethnic groups. And so God is saying, from the people who descend from you, I'm going to make available to all the ethnic groups in the whole world my tremendous blessing. Well, Abraham had a son, Isaac, and Isaac had a son, Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons who became the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And when Jacob was near death, he pronounced a prophetic word over each of his 12 sons and the tribes that would descend from them. This is in Genesis 49. And when Jacob spoke to his son Judah, he said to him, the scepter, that's the rod of rulership, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. A lot of our versions just transliterate the word Shiloh rather than translating its meaning. Shiloh means he to whom it belongs. So what is it saying? It's saying that from the tribe of Judah will come a line of kings, and that line of kings will not be
extinguished, but rather it will lead to the king to whom kingship truly belongs. This is the blessing. The blessing is that God is going to provide the world with a king, his chosen ruler, who will rule the world with justice and equity, and to him will be the obedience of the peoples, all the different ethnic groups all over the world, a worldwide king and kingdom. That's the blessing. Well, fast forward to about 1000 AD, so many centuries later, God selects Israel's second king, David. And after David consolidates his kingship, he gets in his mind the idea of building God a temple. God, in response, sends a prophet named Nathan to him to say, that's great intentions, David, but not. That's really not what God wants you to do. That'll be something that your son can do. But God wants you to know that he's going to build your house. You're not going to build a house for him, but he's going to build your house. And he didn't mean your house like, you know, your digs. He meant your line, your dynasty. And here's what God said then to David in that context. He says, when your days are complete, I will raise up your descendant after you, Solomon. And it goes on, and he says, I'll establish Solomon's kingdom. Tells some more things about Solomon's reign, that he's going to mess things up sometimes, and God will discipline him, but he won't reject him. And then God says, and your house, that is your line, and your kingdom will endure before me forever, and your throne will be established forever. Do you see how this ties into what God said to Abraham and to Judah? That this king who is going to rule forever over God's kingdom is going to come from the kingly line descending from David. David was from the tribe of Judah. Well, after God says this, you should read the account. David is like blown away. He's like, why me? You know, I'm a nobody. Why would you do this for me? It's a good question. You don't know, because God is gracious. And David says, this is your charter for humanity. I know what this is. This is that promise you made to Abraham. You're going to fulfill it through my descendants. And so that is why Matthew, the New Testament, begins verse 1. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, who was the descendant of Abraham and the descendant of David. Now, you may be thinking, well, I bet there were a lot of people who were descendants of Abraham and David. And of course, the answer to that is, yes, there were. This was not a sufficient proof that Jesus was the Messiah. It was a necessary, though not sufficient, condition. This would have been enough to eliminate him from consideration if he was not from David's line. And then what Matthew proceeds to do is to give dozens of examples of other Old Testament predictions about the Messiah that Jesus fulfilled. And so these predictions, no one of them is conclusive, but they act like converging lines. They're interlocking. And as you multiply predictions, the odds of chance fulfillment become so astronomical that it takes a lot of faith not to see this life as the fulfillment of God's prediction. We'll get into that more in the coming weeks. Now, let's close out here this morning by looking at a second answer to why Matthew begins with this genealogy. You know, all Jewish genealogies at this time were selective. They tended to be kind of like a highlights film of someone's ancestry, kind of like what we like to do. We like to airbrush, you know, our ancestry. I like to talk about Robert E. Lee, not Jefferson Davis, right? Matthew's also is highly selective, but it includes some very unusual names, names that you would not normally include. Specifically, I'm underlining here Tamar, Rahab, Ruth,
and Bathsheba. Now, you notice prior to each of their names is the word by. And that tips you off to the fact of their gender, right? That these people were born by these women. Well, that's interesting for a number of reasons. For one thing, these, as I said, are all women which were not normally included in male-dominated Jewish first-century society. That's considered bad taste. And yet Matthew is deliberately including them, that Jesus came from not only women, obviously, but from these women. And I think the reason for that, as you read the Gospels, you'll see, part of the reason why he wants you to know that Jesus came from these women is that he came for women like this. And all the accounts of Jesus deliberately initiating with Jewish women, Samaritan women, non-Jewish women, to the point where the religious leaders were like offended that he hung out with women. At one point in Luke's gospel, Luke is talking about all the people who were Jesus' apprentices, and he deliberately named several women who were his disciples. Unheard of in that time. Well, it's not just that these four names are women. They were also non-Jewish women. Tamar and Rahab were Canaanites. Ruth was a Moabitess from Moab. And Bathsheba was a Hittite, like her husband Uriah. Again, in first century Jewish genealogies, the names that you would put out there would be all Jewish names, because the point was to demonstrate your Jewish pedigree. Ideally, you're a full-blooded Jew. Jesus was not a full-blooded Jew. And Matthew, it's like writing to Jews saying, what do you think about this? Two Canaanite ancestors, a Moabite ancestor, and a Hittite ancestor. And of course, the point that he's going to argue in his gospel is that Jesus came in part from Gentiles because he came for Gentiles, not just for the Jewish people. He didn't come just for the chosen nation. He came for all nations to fulfill that promise God made to Abraham, that through this person, I'm going to give a blessing to all the ethnic groups in the whole world. And then there's a third thing about these women, and that is that they were all either very broken women and or very sinful women. Like, this is like rolling out the dirty laundry right here. Okay, Tamar, who was Tamar? She was Judah's daughter-in-law. Judah cut her out of the family inheritance. And so Tamar disguised herself as a prostitute, solicited Judah on a business trip, had sex with him, got pregnant by it, and blackmailed him through his own child to get her inheritance. You want to talk about dysfunctional families? I mean, that is a dysfunctional, broken family. And Matthew's like, yeah, and it isn't an amazing that God deliberately included her as being one through whom the Messiah would come? Or how about Rahab? Rahab was a prostitute by profession. And when it speaks of Rahab's house in the book of Joshua, it's very possible that the house refers not to her digs, but to her house of prostitution. That's what she did. Okay, and so when the two Jewish spies were hiding from the Jericho police, she chose to hide them because she had become convinced that their God was probably the true God. And we read that because of that, God spared her life during the conquest of Jericho, and she wound up getting married to one of those Jewish men. And oh, yeah, by the way, she's part of the line, the chosen line of the Messiah. Ruth, she's a pretty good babe. Really, Ruth was, as I said, from Moab. And she lived in Moab with her sister and her brother-in-law and her mother-in-law and her father-in-law, who were Jews. And then in a very short period of time, something terrible happened. Ruth's husband died. her brother-in-law died and her father-in-law died. And, you know, that in the ancient world was a, that's a tragedy of colossal proportions, not the least of which is because that would plunge these women into desperate poverty. Her mother-in-law says, well, I'm going to go back to Israel because maybe I get some relatives there. And so she decides to go back with her to the land of Israel. And there, even though they're really in danger of poverty and ostracism, this older, kindly Jewish man winds up falling in love with her and making her his wife and caring for her. And then from her comes the line straight to David. But then there's Bathsheba. You know, David had sent her husband Uriah out to this battle that David should have been leading. David stayed home to play video games and watch porn. Or the 10th century BC equivalent thereof. And, you know, in that self-indulgent state, he looks across at another house, and there Bathsheba's taking a bath, and he just decides, I got to have sex with her right now. Urgent. So he abuses his power totally to get her brought to his house. He has sex with her. He gets her pregnant. And then he arranges to try to have her husband come home and have sex with her to cover up what he did. And when that doesn't work, he arranges for the murder of her husband to whitewash the whole situation. That's pretty broken. That's pretty dysfunctional right there. And God busts David out through Nathan in a very famous dramatic sequence. And God said, there's going to be a ripple effect of pain from your wrong choices that I'm not going to spare you from. But then God chooses Bathsheba to be the one who by whom is Solomon and by whom the Messiah comes. Do you see what Matthew's doing? He's saying, look, Jesus, I want you to know that he came from really sinful, really broken people because that's who he came for. He didn't come just for the elites. He didn't just come just for the together people. He didn't come as one more addition to your own self-help program. He came as a savior to rescue broken, sinful people. And this is one of the ways that God emphasizes that great news for us. After all, it was Jesus himself who said, the Son of Man, referring to himself, has come to seek and to save that which is lost. I love that verse. I love it in part because I came to Christ the night that I finally admitted to myself that I was lost. I didn't use that term, but I remember very vividly admitting to myself for the first time in my life, my plan for my life is not working, and I don't have any idea what a good plan is. And it was in that context that I met the living Christ, and he rescued me. He saved me, saved my butt. I think about that 46 years ago, and as time goes on, I just keep looking back and appreciating in deeper and deeper ways what he rescued me. I didn't even view myself as a broken sinner. I would have been offended if you said that to me. Now, 46 years later, I've got a little bit better perspective on how broken and sinful I really am. And I can afford to see that about myself because Jesus is for me. He forgives me. He's entered into my life to redeem my life, to make something good out of a life that didn't deserve it. This is why the people in Israel who had the hardest time with Jesus was people who didn't admit that they were lost, that they were sinners, that they were broken. He said, I didn't even come for people who think they're righteous or think they're well. I came for the people who know that they're sinners, and for the people who know that they're broken. That's who I came for. And you will find as you go through your life that in various ways, God is intervening, trying to get your attention and to pierce through your self-confidence or your pride or your self-righteousness, and just to get you to admit, I don't know where I'm going. I am messed up. My life is a mess because of what other people have done to me and because of how I've contributed to this mess through my own wrong choices. It's when we're honestly willing to tell God, yeah, that's the truth about me, that Jesus Christ suddenly like looms up in front of you and you realize this is where my hope is, because he came for people like me. I don't miss the cut because I'm sinful and broken. I make the cut because I admit that I'm sinful and broken. On the other hand, you may be here thinking, boy, this is just really offensive to me. You know, I've worked hard to put my life together and I've done a lot of good. And I really don't like it when people talk about, you know, me this way, because who do they know? Well, God knows. And God says. And you need to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God so that he can rescue you and then lift you up and remake your life. That's what he calls you to do. That's why he sent Jesus. So anyway, yep, Paul says it's a trustworthy statement. That means you can take this to the bank, deserving full acceptance that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, among whom I am foremost of all. Did Paul really believe that he was the absolute worst sinner that ever lived? I don't know. I think Paul is saying, I know myself better than I know any other sinner. So I know that I'm sinful more than I know that anyone else is more sinful than me. Yeah. I love this lyric from a song that I found many years ago, because it expresses the attitude that Jesus came for. This artist says, you can have my heart, though it isn't new. It's been used and broken, and it only comes in blue. It's been down a long road, and it got dirty on the way. If I give it to you, will you make it clean and wash the shame away? So beyond repair, nothing I could do. I tried to fix it myself, but it was only worse when I got through. Then you walked right into my darkness, and you speak words so sweet, you hold me like a child till my frozen tears fall at your feet. You can have my heart if you don't mind broken things. You can have my life if you don't mind these tears. I've heard that you make old things new. So I give these pieces all to you. If you want it, you can have my heart. That's the attitude that Jesus responds to with forgiveness and redemption. Next week, we're going to cover Jesus' birth and childhood. That'll be an interesting workout. Won't be so hard to do all of it because there's hardly anything written about his childhood that we can trust anyway.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.